Thank you for being a valued supporter of the 10X Podcast Group. Your dedication means the world to us. Today, we bring you a historical review of Guyana, A Journey Through Time. Your continued support and subscription fuel our passion for storytelling, and we deeply appreciate every moment you spend with us. So, without further ado, let's dive into today's compelling narrative. Chapter 1, The Cradle of Civilization. In the heart of South America, where the land embraced the meeting of sprawling rivers and dense rainforests, there was a place untouched by the world's chaos. This land, which would one day be called Guyana, was alive long before maps bore its name. Its story begins with the heartbeat of its first people, the Arawaks, the Caribs, and the Wereo, nurtured by the rhythms of nature and the wisdom passed down through generations. The arrival. Long before European ships dared cross the Atlantic, the ancestors of the Arawaks journeyed from the Orinoco River Basin. Their canoes glided over rivers that glittered like veins of silver under the sun, carrying dreams of fertile lands and bountiful waters. They were a people of quiet strength, carving out lives in harmony with the land. They named their settlements after the rivers that fed them, Essequibo, Demerara, and Berbice, names that would echo through centuries. The Arawaks were not alone for long. The Caribs, fierce warriors and seafarers, followed in their wake. Where the Arawaks sought peace, the Caribs pursued power, their arrival marked by swift raids and whispered warnings. Yet, for all their conflict, both peoples shared a profound connection to the land. It was not theirs to own, but theirs to respect, to live with as part of a greater whole. A world of balance. The forests teemed with life, capuchin monkeys leaping through canopies, jaguars prowling the shadows, and flocks of scarlet macaws painting the skies. The Arawaks and Caribs understood this land, for they had learned its language. They knew which plants healed and which killed. The cassava root, both poison and sustenance, was transformed into bread through skillful preparation, a testament to their ingenuity. Villages were alive with stories told by the fireside. Elders spoke of the Great Spirit who lived in the rivers, the mountains, and the trees, shaping their world and guiding their paths. The people believed in a balance that must never be broken. Each hunt was offered to the spirits, and each harvest was a gift from the earth. This reverence for nature defined their existence, uniting them despite their differences. The Wereo, people of the water. Further north, where the rivers stretched wide and lazy, the Wereo people thrived. Known as the boat people, they built their homes on stilts above the water, a testimony to their resourcefulness. They lived as one with the rivers, crafting canoes from towering silk cotton trees. With nets and spears, they harvested fish, their main source of sustenance. The Wereo were storytellers and dreamers. They believed that their ancestors sailed on moonlit rivers to the spirit world. Their shamans, revered and feared, claimed to walk between realms, seeking wisdom to guide their people. The Wereo's songs filled the nights, blending with the symphony of frogs and cicadas, creating a melody of a life both harsh and beautiful. Conflict and harmony. Though the Arawaks, Caribs, and Wereo were bound by the same land, their interactions were not always peaceful. The Caribs' reputation as warriors often led to clashes with the Arawaks, who saw themselves as protectors of peace. Raids were swift and brutal, leaving villages scarred and survivors wary. But there were also moments of harmony, alliances forged in necessity, trade that bridged differences, and rituals shared under the same stars. The land demanded unity, even if its people could not always find it. Legends of the land. Stories became the threads that wove their world together. The Arawaks told of Makanema, the great creator who fashioned the rivers and mountains. They spoke of the Kaieteur Falls, where a great chief sacrificed himself to save his people, his spirit forever guarding the roaring cascade. For the Caribs, legends were warnings and lessons, teaching strength and resilience. These stories, passed from lips to ears over generations, became the unwritten history of Guyana's first peoples. A tapestry of myth and memory that would later collide with the harsh realities of conquest and colonization. A foreshadowing. The rhythms of life in this untouched paradise were steady, but change loomed on the horizon. Unseen forces were already shaping the winds, bringing whispers of strangers from across the seas. These strangers would not revere the land as the Arawaks, Caribs, and Wereo had. They would not see its rivers as life but as wealth, its forests not as sanctuary but as resources to exploit. For now, though, the land remained theirs. The rivers sang their songs, the forests whispered their secrets, and the people thrived in the embrace of the world they had always known. Chapter 2, First Contact. The wind carried whispers of change long before the sails of foreign ships pierced the horizon. For the Arawaks, Caribs, and Wereo, the land was sacred, its bounty shared among all who revered it. Yet, the arrival of strangers would alter this delicate balance forever. These newcomers, pale-skinned, armored, and armed, sought not harmony but dominion, wielding strange tools, insatiable greed, and a language unknown to the land's first inhabitants. The arrival of the strangers. The first sighting of the Europeans filled the Arawak villagers with a mix of awe and apprehension. Canoes made of wood and vines seemed primitive against these towering vessels with their vast white sails, cutting through the Essequibo River like ominous spirits. The villagers stood in silence, their faces painted with colors of curiosity and caution, as the ships anchored close to the shore. The elders gathered, their voices heavy with wisdom. "They come from the sea, like the spirits of the underworld," murmured one. Another elder, more skeptical, replied, "They are men, not spirits. And men have desires." When the strangers disembarked, they brought gifts, beads that glittered like stars, blades sharper than stone tools, and mirrors that reflected astonished faces. The Arawaks welcomed them with cassava bread, smoked fish, and water in earthen jars. To the Arawaks, hospitality was sacred, a bond shared between all who respected the land. But the Caribs, watching from hidden vantage points, felt no such obligation. Cultural misunderstandings. What the Arawaks saw as hospitality, the Europeans interpreted as submission. These strangers, led by explorers like Alonso de Ojeda and Vicente Yanez Pinzon, came seeking gold and riches, drawn by tales of El Dorado. The Arawaks, however, had no concept of wealth as the Europeans understood it. For them, gold was merely a decorative metal, beautiful but without the power to dictate lives. The Arawaks offered stories of the land's treasures, their words shaped by myth and reverence. "The rivers run with gold," they said, referring to the sunlight that danced on the water's surface. But the Europeans, blinded by greed, took the words literally. The Arawaks quickly realized their mistake when the newcomers demanded to see the rivers of gold. Fear crept into their villages, yet the elders urged caution, not conflict. The Caribs, on the other hand, viewed the Europeans with hostility. Warriors painted their bodies with red anato and black genipa, preparing for confrontation. For generations, the Caribs had protected their territories fiercely, and they saw these strangers as another threat to be conquered. Their raids on European encampments were swift and brutal, leaving the survivors trembling with fear of the savage Caribs. A clash of worldviews. The Europeans, unfamiliar with the harmony between the indigenous peoples and the land, saw only resources to be extracted. To the Arawaks, a tree was sacred, a home for birds, a provider of shade, a source of medicine. To the Europeans, it was timber for profit. The rivers, which the Wereo believed to be the lifeblood of the earth, were for the newcomers merely a means of navigation and conquest. These clashing worldviews led to misunderstandings that often ended in bloodshed. One such moment occurred when a Spanish expedition demanded laborers to help build their fortifications. The Arawaks, unaccustomed to forced labor, refused. In retaliation, the Europeans seized several villagers as captives. The Caribs, hearing of this act, launched an attack on the Spanish encampment, their war cries echoing through the jungle. The battle was fierce, but the Caribs, armed only with spears and arrows, were no match for the Europeans' steel weapons and firearms. Indigenous diplomacy. Despite these conflicts, the Arawaks made efforts to negotiate with the newcomers. Their leaders approached the Europeans with gifts and warnings, hoping to establish a fragile peace. One elder, known as Amara, spoke through gestures and fragmented words to convey the sacredness of the land. "You take the earth's gifts," he said, pointing to the trees, the rivers, and the sky, "but give nothing back. The land grows angry when it is not respected." His words were met with confused smiles and dismissive nods. The Europeans, however, were not entirely without humanity. Among the explorers was a young navigator named Diego, who showed genuine interest in the Arawak's way of life. He learned their language slowly, sitting by their fires and listening to their stories. Through Diego, the Arawaks hoped to find a bridge to understanding, but even he was bound by the ambitions of his people. A moment of harmony. There were fleeting moments of harmony. The Europeans marveled at the Arawaks' intricate hammocks, which they quickly adopted for their own use. They learned to prepare cassava without succumbing to its poison and admired the craftsmanship of the Wereo canoes, which glided effortlessly through the rivers. For a brief time, it seemed as if coexistence was possible. The Caribs, too, found common ground in trade. Though wary of the strangers, they exchanged tobacco, feathers, and food for steel tools and beads. These moments of peace were fragile, however, and often shattered by greed or fear. Foreshadowing the storm, the arrival of the Europeans marked the beginning of an irreversible transformation. The diseases they carried, smallpox, measles, and influenza, spread like wildfire, devastating villages that had no immunity. The rivers that once sustained life now carried death. Entire communities vanished, their stories lost to time. For the Arawaks, Caribs, and Wario, the land remained sacred, but its future was slipping from their grasp. The Europeans saw the rivers as highways to power, the forests as barriers to be cleared, and the people as obstacles to be subdued. The harmony that had defined this land for centuries was fracturing, setting the stage for centuries of exploitation and resistance. Chapter 3: The Age of Colonization. The dawn of the 17th century saw the rivers of Guyana bustling with the ambitions of new arrivals. After the Spanish explorers had carved their fleeting presence into the region, it was the Dutch who sought to make the land their own. The Essequibo, Demerara, and Berbice rivers became the lifeblood of their colonies, gateways to a territory they believed held untold wealth. But where the Arawaks, Caribs, and Wario saw the land as sacred, the Dutch saw only opportunity. The era of colonization began not with diplomacy, but with fortresses and plantations, laying the foundation for centuries of exploitation and resistance. The foundations of power. The Dutch West India Company, eager to expand its influence in the Americas, established settlements along the Essequibo River in the early 1600s. Wooden fortresses rose along the riverbanks, their cannons pointed not at enemies on the horizon, but at the local inhabitants they sought to subjugate. Fort Kwaikeoveral, nestled at the confluence of the Essequibo and Mazaruni rivers, became a symbol of Dutch ambition and dominance. The land's first inhabitants were drawn into this new colonial order. The Arawaks, known for their diplomacy, were coerced into providing labor and resources. The Caribs, unwilling to bow to foreign powers, waged guerrilla warfare from the dense forests. The Wario, retreating to the waterways, resisted through isolation, their canoes disappearing into the labyrinth of mangroves. Despite the Dutch fortifications, survival in this unfamiliar land was no guarantee. Tropical diseases, relentless heat, and the dense, unforgiving rainforest claimed many European lives. It was the indigenous peoples, with their profound knowledge of the land, who often ensured the colonizers' survival, sometimes willingly, often under duress. The rise of plantations. With the land subdued, the Dutch turned their attention to profit. Sugar, the white gold of the colonial era, became the heart of their economy. Plantations sprawled along the rivers, their fields of sugarcane shimmering under the relentless sun. But this wealth came at an unbearable cost. The indigenous labor force, unable to endure the brutality of plantation life, dwindled under the strain of disease, mistreatment, and resistance. The Dutch turned to a darker solution, the transatlantic slave trade. Ships began to arrive, their holds filled with African men, women, and children torn from their homelands and thrust into a life of unimaginable suffering. The enslaved Africans brought with them more than labor. They carried stories, songs, and traditions, fragments of the lives they had been forced to leave behind. These fragments became seeds, planted in the soil of Guyana, growing into a cultural legacy that would endure long after the chains were broken. Rebellion and resistance. The plantation system was built on violence, but it was also built on fear. The enslaved Africans, though beaten and broken, found ways to resist. Some fled into the forests, forming maroon communities that became sanctuaries of freedom. These maroons, often aided by the Caribs, launched daring raids on plantations, liberating captives and striking fear into the hearts of their oppressors. The most significant of these uprisings came in 1763, in the colony of Berbice. An enslaved man named Cuffy led a rebellion that nearly overthrew Dutch control. For months, the rebels held the colony, establishing their own rule and demanding freedom. Though the rebellion was ultimately crushed, Cuffy's name became a symbol of resistance, his legacy woven into the identity of a people determined to be free. The Dutch and their rivals. As the Dutch solidified their hold on Guyana, they faced challenges not only from within, but also from without. The French and British, hungry for their share of the New World, launched incursions into Dutch territory. Guyana became a battleground for European powers, its rivers running red with the blood of soldiers who fought not for the land, but for its wealth. The indigenous peoples, caught between these warring powers, played a precarious game of survival. Some allied with the Dutch, seeking protection from their traditional enemies. Others sided with the British or French, hoping to weaken the colonial grip on their lands. But for most, these alliances were temporary, born of necessity rather than loyalty. The seeds of change. By the late 18th century, the cracks in the colonial system were beginning to show. Enlightenment ideals of liberty and equality began to seep into the colonies, carried by whispers from Europe and the Americas. Enslaved Africans and indigenous peoples alike began to dream of a world without chains, a world where the land they toiled on would once again belong to them. The Dutch, sensing the winds of change, clung desperately to their power. But the world was shifting beneath their feet. The age of colonization was entering a new phase, one that would bring both hope and hardship to the land and its people. Chapter 4: The British Takeover. As the 19th century dawned, the rivers of Guyana reflected the shifting tides of power. The Dutch, who had established a precarious grip on the land, found their empire unraveling. Across Europe, the Napoleonic Wars were redrawing borders, and in the Caribbean, Britain was emerging as the dominant colonial power. In 1814, the Treaty of Paris sealed the fate of the Dutch colonies in Guyana, handing Essequibo, Demerara, and Berbice to the British. With this transfer of power, the region stepped into a new chapter, one marked by sweeping changes and enduring struggles. The British vision. The British arrived with grand ambitions. Unlike the Dutch, whose control had been patchwork and transactional, the British sought to create a more structured and profitable colony. They envisioned a land of flourishing plantations, bustling ports, and obedient labor. To achieve this, they expanded the plantation economy, focusing on sugar as the engine of prosperity. The indigenous peoples, already diminished by disease and displacement, found themselves further marginalized. The British paid little attention to their plight, seeing them as relics of a bygone era. For the enslaved Africans, however, the British arrival brought both new hardships and the faint glimmer of hope. A new system of control. Under British rule, the plantation economy became even more entrenched. Massive estates sprawled along the rivers, their profits fueling the British Empire. The enslaved Africans bore the brunt of this expansion, enduring backbreaking labor under the watchful eyes of overseers armed with whips. The British implemented strict laws to maintain control, criminalizing even the smallest acts of resistance. Punishments were swift and brutal, designed to instill fear. Yet, despite these efforts, rebellion simmered beneath the surface. The memory of Cuffy's uprising in Berbice lingered, inspiring whispered plans for freedom among the enslaved. To enforce their authority, the British deployed soldiers and constructed new fortifications. Georgetown, renamed from its Dutch predecessor Stabroek, became the colony's administrative and military hub. The city grew quickly, its streets filled with merchants, colonial officials, and laborers, creating a stark contrast to the rural plantations where life remained harsh and unyielding. The winds of abolition. In Britain, the abolitionist movement was gaining momentum. The horrors of slavery, once hidden behind the walls of plantations, were being exposed through books, speeches, and testimonies. Figures like William Wilberforce championed the cause, rallying public opinion against the institution. For the enslaved Africans in Guyana, these distant efforts offered a faint ray of hope. News of the abolitionist movement traveled slowly but surely, carried by sailors, missionaries, and occasional letters. In 1807, Britain outlawed the transatlantic slave trade, a significant step, but one that did little to improve conditions for those already enslaved. The enslaved people of Guyana were not passive recipients of change. Acts of defiance, sabotaging equipment, escaping to maroon communities, and organizing revolts continued to challenge the system. The most significant of these revolts came in 1823, in Demerara, where over 10,000 enslaved people rose up demanding their freedom. Though the rebellion was suppressed, it sent shockwaves through the colony and beyond, intensifying calls for emancipation. Emancipation and its aftermath. In 1834, slavery was abolished across the British Empire, marking a monumental turning point in Guyana's history. For the newly freed Africans, emancipation was both a triumph and a new challenge. The British introduced an apprenticeship system, which required former slaves to continue working on plantations for a period of time, often under conditions that differed little from slavery. When the apprenticeship system ended in 1838, many freed Africans chose to leave the plantations altogether, seeking independence through small-scale farming and other trades. Villages sprang up across the countryside, their names, Victoria, Buxton, and Queenstown, reflecting both a nod to British influence and a declaration of freedom. The exodus of African laborers left the plantations struggling to maintain production. To address this, the British turned to a new source of labor, indentured servants from India, China, and Portugal. Ships began to arrive in Guyana's harbors, carrying men and women who had been promised opportunities but found themselves trapped in a new system of exploitation. Indigenous marginalization. While the British focused on the plantation economy, the indigenous peoples of Guyana were pushed further into the hinterlands. The Arawaks, Caribs, and Wario, once central to the region's history, became invisible to the colonial authorities. Missionaries ventured into their territories, seeking to convert them to Christianity and integrate them into the colonial order. For the indigenous peoples, this often meant the erosion of their cultural traditions and autonomy. Yet they endured. Through oral histories, rituals, and a deep connection to the land, the indigenous communities preserved their identity. In the forests and rivers of Guyana, their stories remained alive, a testament to their resilience. A complex society. By the mid-19th century, Guyana had become a mosaic of cultures and contradictions. The Afro-Guyanese, freed but still struggling for equality, sought to carve out lives of dignity and independence. The indentured laborers, arriving from across the seas, began to establish their own communities, bringing with them new languages, religions, and traditions. The indigenous peoples, though marginalized, continued to resist assimilation, holding fast to their ancestral ways. Georgetown, the colony's capital, reflected this complexity. Its bustling streets were a blend of European architecture, Afro-Guyanese energy, and the vibrant colors and sounds of Indian, Chinese, and Portuguese influences. But beneath the surface, tensions simmered. The rigid hierarchy of colonial society ensured that power remained firmly in British hands, leaving the rest to compete for their place in the social order. Foreshadowing the future, the British takeover had transformed Guyana, setting the stage for both progress and conflict. The seeds of multiculturalism had been planted, but so too had the roots of inequality and division. The descendants of enslaved Africans, indentured laborers, and indigenous peoples would inherit a land rich in diversity, but scarred by its colonial past. As the 19th century marched on, the people of Guyana began to imagine a future beyond colonial rule. The journey would be long and fraught with challenges, but the dream of a free and united Guyana was taking shape.